The Hidden Forces podcast features long-form conversations broken into two parts, the second hour of which is made available to our premium subscribers, along with transcripts and notes to each conversation. For more information about how to access the episode overtimes, transcripts, and rundowns, head over to patreon.com/hiddenforces. You can also sign up to our mailing list at hiddenforces.io, follow us on Twitter at Hidden Forces Pod, and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? Unless you've been living under a rock or you don't have an internet connection, you will already know that some really crazy shit happened in the last couple of weeks involving the stock price of video game retailer GameStop, a number of large Wall Street institutions, and an online community subreddit called Wall Street Bets that has now grown to over 8 million users. There have been so many competing explanations put forward for what happened here that it would be impossible for me to try and summarize all of them. Instead, I decided to invite on someone who has done really interesting work trying to understand the mechanics of how it happened. How, in other words, an online community of primarily retail investors managed to pump the price of GameStop stock to such a level that they forced the institutional investors who were short the stock to cover, and in the case of hedge fund Melvin Capital, to seek a nearly $3 billion bailout from some of its biggest backers, including Citadel and Point72 Asset Management. In my conversation with Lily, we look at how both knowledge about market structure and the endogenous dynamics of the options market, combined with the proliferation of narrative in the form of internet memes, were used to organize, coordinate, and execute on what was effectively a community-sourced short squeeze that caused chaos across Wall Street and left the financial press and the public scrambling for answers. While the conversation about options is specific to Wall Street, the memetic component of this story is the one that I find most fascinating, not only because understanding online culture and how narratives spread on the internet can help you capitalize on trends and monetize momentum, but also because its application extends to pretty much any use case you can imagine, from investing to fundraising to organizing large-scale political movements. For anyone listening who is already pretty well-versed in options trading, I've provided time codes in the summary section so you can skip ahead if you feel the need to. In place of an overtime, I've invited on Real Vision editor and former CNBC reporter Ash Bennington for a further discussion about the events of the last week, the insanity we've been seeing in markets, and what to expect going forward. You can access that overtime by visiting our website at hiddenforces.io or directly through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. There's also a link in the summary section with instructions on how to connect the overtime feed to your phone so you can listen to these extra discussions just like you listen to the regular podcast. And with that, please enjoy this incredibly insightful conversation with my guest, Lily Frankis. Lily Frankis, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I am super excited to have you on, Lily. This is going to be a giant geek fest, geekathon, geekathon.
I'm the kind of person who's late at night posts backtests on Twitter, so.
Oh, I know. Trust me. I'm very excited. So, before we get into the meat of this discussion, which is going to deal with GameStop and the blast radius of the God meme, stick around for an explanation to that. Maybe you can start us off by giving me and our listeners an idea of who you are and your background. You're a 25-year-old PhD student in bioinformatics who apparently has a side hobby of trading options and also studying memetics on the internet. So how does that all fit in? Tell me, where did you come from? What's your background? And how did you find yourself doing such interesting work on this really, really timely story.
Definitely. So, I mean, I guess it all starts, I have always been, you know, kind of a dilettante in a lot of things. I've always had a, you know, deep interest in, you know, linguistics. I actually started a linguistics club way back when in high school, which, you know, you really can't get more nerdy than that. You know, I think we looked once and the only other linguistics club high school level was in like Georgia, the country, not even the state of Georgia.
Interesting.
And I mean, I went to college and pursued a background in computer science and business. So I got, you know, about as many finance classes as you learn how to price, you know, a basic bond. Spent a couple of years in the tech industry, which a couple, again, you know, given my age, was like about four. So worked at LinkedIn and Stripe, you know, got a feel of that stuff and, you know, doing full stack dev. I've, you know, been involved previously in some startups that, you know, as most startups went, you know, ended up with closure rather than being acquired by some cool VC. But it really inspired me to look into the biology side of applications of technology. I actually started my PhD fairly recently. You know, I'm a student at UC San Diego. And I picked up options mostly when everybody else did. We also, the market crash. I spent most of the actual crash just hoping Microsoft would hit like 125 so I could buy more. I never did, you know, learned my first lesson about greed and timing there. And I started actually day trading because I knew I was going from this highly paid job in the tech industry to being a PhD student. And it was like, maybe I could use my quantitative background plus everything just seems to be going up right now to make some money on the market.
So when you say the crash, you mean the 2020 crash this past March, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I mean, I've been an investor for years. You know, I started investing pretty much with my first job in 2016. But I, you know, I was a reader of Wall Street Bets for the last couple of years. Like their memes were always pretty fire. But I never, you know, really delved into the option side of things. But it seemed like a good opportunity because, you know, we were all home, we were all bored, and it was like, hey, there's free money to be made.
Yeah. So what is bioinformatics for those who don't know?
So bioinformatics is really like a broad topic. It's basically the application of computational methods to biology. So it spans the gamut from making crappy like EMRs like Epic. You know, if you ever interacted with hospital systems that record your information, they're mostly garbage. No offense to any of your listeners who work at Epic. But basically, on my side, it's more on the genetics, genomic side. So it's like, you know, we have this biological data, usually these sequences of, you know, exons or introns. Can we align them to existing data? So that's a reference genome. Can we understand how, let's say, these sequences relate to phenotypic data? So it's very, very broad.
Hmm. Interesting. So we'll be touching back. We'll be making use of your, I think, your interest in bioinformatics when we get into our conversations about memetics. And that'll also pull from linguistics as well. Last question about you before we move into the actual substance. Your Twitter handle, for those who are interested in following you, is nope_its_lily. So nope, it's Lily. One, how did you come up with that name? I'm just curious, like, what's the background there?
I mean, I joined Twitter in late October of last year because I do a lot of work on this model called Nope, which some of you might have already heard of just because it's been gaining popularity this past month. It effectively looks at delta flows on the S&P 500. And if you're not familiar with delta flows, I'll get into that later with more about option trading in general. And it stands for the net options pricing effect. So it's really this understanding of how much the weight of delta hedging options is driving the price dynamics of, let's say, the S&P 500. So my handle in particular is more of like a play on words. It's like, nope, my model, it's Lily.
So let's get into options. Let's get into derivatives and let's get into the market mechanics and market structure side of the story. I don't know if I mentioned this when we started recording, but I certainly said it to you before we began, which was that as I've come to understand it, reading your interpretation of this story, and I think generally my own understanding as well, is that there are really two large mechanical components to how some of these stocks, in this case GME, get pumped or have gotten pumped. Mm-hmm. And one has to do with the market structure and the use particularly of short-dated call options. Before we get into that, or kind of as we get into it, give me and my listeners a summary slash update. So a summary of like what happened the last 2 weeks and where are we? Because it's not just about GameStop. It's not just about the subreddit Wall Street Bets. It's not just about Robinhood. It's kind of more and more players got into this story, people trying to capitalize and use it for their own particular narratives, et cetera, et cetera. It's kind of actually like an interesting narrative war situation. A lot of competing narratives getting flooded into the zone. So give me and my listeners a summary, and then give me an update on where we are at this moment.
GameStop was a very interesting story. I mean, a lot of people, it only came on their radar, I would say, about a week and a half ago, you know, when it originally pumped from, I think it was around $40 to about $70 within a day. And everybody was like, whoa, what just happened? I mean, it had been growing for months. My background is in day trading. I've been involved in communities like Wall Street Bets. And GameStop was always known, you know, for months, years, it's this value trap. I mean, if you look at their chart, it had been on a perpetual downtrend pretty much since like 2008. It had two boom cycles with the last consoles, you know, which is an important part of this narrative story, because one of the major drivers for the initial flows was this idea that the new consoles are coming out, so GameStop would benefit. But it gets a bit more complicated. I mean, the story really begins with this guy, you know, on Reddit named Deep Fucking Value. Everybody's heard of him by now. You know, he also goes by Roaring Kitty on YouTube. And he had been in this GameStop, you know, position since about September 2019, if I remember. So he really did look for, you know, this deep value. He lived up to his name. And when he first posted on Wall Street Bets, nobody knew who this guy was. They just knew he put like $50,000 on GameStop. Everybody saw GameStop as this archaic, you know, once behemoth that was going to be bankrupt probably within a year. And I mean, you know, logically speaking, it was a failing game store in the middle of the worst pandemic in the last 100 years. From what I remember with the original narrative, he was posting every week or every 2 weeks updates to his positions, which were really just a screenshot of his portfolio. And nobody really paid attention until I would say about April 2020. When people started paying attention was when GameStop actually hit its lowest point, which was around $4, basically at the bottom of this pandemic.
When was that? And that was it. That was in April?
It was, let me just quickly refer to the chart. It was roughly, I mean, it was $4 as late as August of 2020.
Okay, so interesting.
I think it might have even hit $3 or $2. It was bad. I mean, it really looked like GameStop was on its last legs. And I mean, who could blame people for thinking that, given it was a game store in the middle of a pandemic during an e-commerce revolution? Like, I really could not think of a worse position to be in. So what's interesting, though, is this guy, Deep Fucking Value, just kept holding. And people, you know, admired. He was down a pretty substantial amount of money at varying points. He actually started, I think, right before one of GameStop's earnings in 2019. So he did pull some money out at the point. But he held through 2020, which was, again, the lowest point in GameStop's history. And, you know, it didn't really start gaining traction until, I would say, early September, late, you know, September, when another central, you know, character to the story, Ryan Cohen, appeared. And Ryan Cohen, people might know him as this guy who founded Chewy. He also made some famous bets on Apple and Wells Fargo stock, which I believe turned out pretty well for him. And he took this large position. You know, there had been people like Michael Burry, you know, famous from The Big Short, who were previously in GameStop as well. But it really exploded in popularity when this new, like, young, eccentric billionaire character, similar to Elon Musk, was like, I'm going to buy 9% of the company. And people were like, okay, maybe now it is time to join Deep Fucking Value.
So that was like a catalyst moment.
It was. I mean, I talked about this in my post a lot about this, you know, almost hero's journey where, you know, with the help of Ryan Cohen, you know, and these various catalysts that appeared, like Ryan Cohen buying in, Ryan Cohen writing a letter, you know, to the board after, I believe it was winter earnings, GameStop going from $20 to like $14 because they missed earnings quite predictably. You know, these were all points of when people, you know, not only joined the story, but also their faith was tested. And it did turn out they were rewarded in the end. You know, I mean, nobody can deny that those initial investors at $4 probably made a ridiculous amount of money.
Well, especially because they were using leverage. A lot of them were, at least. So you're obviously touching on the narrative, and it's so interesting because I can even tell, speaking to you now for the first time, I could tell reading your writing on this, but now listening to you as well, you really do enjoy the story component of this. So, and I think what's really also really interesting about you is you are unique in that you combine a deep appreciation capacity to analyze the qualitative narrative story-driven aspects of this, the memetics, that is, while at the same time you understand the market structure. So one more question about this narrative thing, and then let's get into the market structure, because I want to try and help listeners separate the two and then combine them where necessary. Am I correct in understanding that this story went from being basically just a, for most of the world, a story about a obscure, not an obscure company, but, you know, an obscure story in the sense that it was a financial stock that was pumping and there was a series of shorts that were squeezed out of their positions, the stock pumped higher, a lot of people made money, et cetera. It went from being that to now becoming this sort of like social political movement about power, corruption, the little guy, social inequality. Am I right that that's how the story has generally transformed over a period of a few weeks?
Yeah, it's been interesting to see. And a lot of it is just, I would blame, you know, the missteps of the financial system in general. I mean, the first hit was Citron. You know, Citron Research, if you're not familiar, it's the handle of a guy, Andrew Left, and he's a short seller. And he's actually a pretty good one. You know, I've jokingly been aligned a lot shorting meme stocks previously with him. So stuff like Laser and Palantir and Neo. But people get pissed, you know, and I'll talk more about this, the hyper-reality of things that we've, you know, talked about before this interview. People know these companies are overvalued. Nobody's going, or few people are going into Palantir at $30 and being like, yeah, something happened in the last 2 months which made it worth more than $10 where it started IPOing at. So, you know, at the same time, he also got kind of lazy, you know, with how he decided to short and basically went from these comprehensive reports, which was more like, you know, Muddy Waters or Carson Block, who, you know, does this research, targets these actual harmful stocks like, you know, Luckin Coffee or maybe IQ. He went from that to, I know what's better for you. I tell you this is worth $20. And Wall Street Bets and the internet were like, okay, you're wrong. You know, now we have a common enemy basically to crystallize against. And this was really reinforced with the Robinhood fiasco. We're still learning the story. I mean, the CEO of Robinhood, I believe, went on Clubhouse with Elon Musk, you know, a day or two ago to kind of give their side. But the optics just looked bad. You know, you had this group of people which were like, we are going to screw with this hedge fund. And, you know, regardless of if Robinhood and the other brokerages had a valid reason, it looked like the system was literally trying to screw people. Mm-hmm. And because of that, you know, you've added this kindling to the fire that even if GameStop dies and, you know, as I talked about on Twitter, it really looks like the end of this bubble. You have these people who, instead of just valuing it based on greed, are like, no, this is actually unfair. I'm going to do this because it aligns with my morality.
So interesting. So one, I do want to discuss Robinhood. It's still a little unclear what happened there, but we can make some assumptions about it. The other point you made, and then we'll touch again on this later as well, about how people, a huge part of this was not even about making money. And I think that's something that like A lot of people don't grasp. Listeners may remember that I made this point to Ben Hunt in our episode with Ben and Grant Williams, which is that a huge part of this is about community and the lack of community and the capacity to find it online. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of these people post, you know, pictures of their accounts getting wrecked. You know, there's a quality, there's a sort of a dopamine response function that is, you know, isn't just about making the thrill of risking money, but also the likes that you get from it. Mm-hmm. When you talked about early on about how GameStop had been this long value trap, and I think you mentioned a few other of these stocks that maybe was Palantir that clearly were overvalued by traditional metrics, there's this fantastic video that I will link to in the summary section of the episode. And of course, it's in my rundown, and I actually have pictures of it in my rundown. I'm sure you saw it, the Joker mm-hmm. video, about 7 minutes long, right? I mean, absolutely yeah. brilliant. And Robert De Niro's character, who plays basically the Johnny Carson of this show, turns to Joker and he goes, "You actually put your life savings into Plug and Fuel Cell? Have you checked their P/E ratio?" You know, the boomer fixated on fundamentals and cash flows. So let's focus in now on the endogenous factors. How much of the movement, in your estimation of GME, of GameStop, was driven by endogenous factors related to derivatives contracts and positioning?
So that's an interesting question. And I mean, you know, it's really open to speculation, which of course this was speculation. I got a lot of flack when on Friday, or when I published my blog post after that Friday, I talked about where, you know, GME actually went from $40 to $70, that I argued that it really wasn't a short squeeze. You know, the jury's still out. We've actually, you know, found that the short interest, at least according to, I think, S3 Partners recently, has dropped from about 130% to about 40%. And, you know, what that means is, of course, the shorts were squeezed. You know, no question that the original people who shorted, especially those who were, you know, haughty enough, you know, or arrogant enough to basically short without coverage or on leverage, they were completely blown out. That said, I mean, you know, when the initial movement happened, it was quite clear to me and a lot of others that this was due to option contracts. This effect, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners have learned the words gamma squeeze in the last week.
I'm sure people are going to need to get clear on that, but continue. We'll explain what it is.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was clear that after a week of, you know, minimal movement, you know, actually GameStop declined, I believe, that week from about $40 opening on Monday to about $37 or $36, that there was a strong option component because it happened on a Friday. And, you know, this was not only reflected based on what's called the volume versus the open interest. So volume is how many options were traded that day versus open interest, which is how many options exist open at the start of the previous day. So you can see, for instance, if the volume is much higher than the open interest, that means there was a lot of options traded. You don't know how many of those were newly opened. You don't know how many of those were traded back and forth, but you can kind of guess. In GME's case, it was very clear based on the shape of how the price was moving that it resembled, you know, a typical gamma squeeze, because you started in the morning with it pretty much flat. You then started seeing it slowly ramp up. And, you know, in my post, I argued that was largely due to, you know, puts expiring, and I can go into what puts and calls are if we want to go, you know, at the
yeah. So let's do that. Because people are going to be scratching their head. They're going to say gamma. What? There are, I think, volatility is also important here, but three important components or important Greek letters. One is delta, one is gamma, and then theta as well. So what is a gamma squeeze? And explain to our listeners how that relates to delta. What is gamma and what is theta? And we're talking about put and call options, and tell people what those are as well for people that don't know.
I'm going to start with the complete basics here. So an option is effectively a promise between one party and another party to buy or sell a stock at a certain price at a certain time. At least we're talking about vanilla options on equities. So for instance, a call option gives the person who is long it or the person who bought it the option to buy a certain stock at a certain price on a certain date. And what that means is that you can actually, for an American option, you can actually exercise it or, you know, turn in your note or promise early if the option is what's called in the money. So an option, you know, based on this promise format consists of two things. It consists of a strike and it consists of a tenor, or most people online call it a date or an expiry.
A strike price and an expiration date.
So let's say GameStop is currently trading at $40 and I buy a call option at $60 that expires on the 19th of February. What that means is if GameStop goes above $60 before then, I could go to the person who wrote that contract and say, you need to sell me 100 shares of GameStop for $60 each. So a total value of $6,000, basically. A put option is actually the opposite. So instead of saying, I want to buy at a certain price on a certain date, it gives you the option to sell at a certain price at a certain date. So in this example, if GameStop is trading at $60, I can buy a put option for $40 on 219, which effectively says no matter what GameStop price is at or before 219, I have the right to sell you this at $40 a share. So you can already see where that's going. So when you're bullish, you know, when you believe a stock is going to go up in value, you're going to buy a call option, because if GameStop, let's say, becomes $80 a share by the expiration, then you go to the person who wrote the option and you say, you owe me 100 shares at $60. Then you could go literally right then and there and sell those shares for $80. Yeah. So you've made effectively a $2,000 profit.
You can sell the underlying security into the market and pocket the difference between what mm-hmm. you paid for the security because you exercised the options contract and what you sold it for in the market because it was trading above the strike price.
Exactly. That's true for a call option. So for a put option, it's the opposite. Effectively, that's when you're bearish. A lot of people use put options as hedges for what are called long positions. So if, let's say, I have 1,000 shares of Microsoft and it's currently trading around 240, I could say, I am afraid Microsoft is going to go down 200 because maybe their earnings are bad. So if I was, you know, sure of that conviction, I could buy 10 put options for $230. And then in case Microsoft falls to 200, I still have the right, but not the, you know, requirement to sell you my shares at 230. What matters here is that, you know, speculators use these options, which were originally, you know, they're kind of an insurance contract.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the whole point of options in general. They're really, you know, historically for insurance. Speculators use them to not only, you know, make money on these bets without putting up all the capital for buying shares, but also because of their convex payout. And what that means is a convex payout is that it's nonlinear. So if I am very bullish, let's say GameStop trading at $40 and I buy a $60 call option, that's considered very out of the money, meaning that I think that to even make my contract worth value, GameStop needs to go up in value very fast and also a lot, you know, 50% to be in the money. And what happens though is that these contracts are sold normally, especially in the context of call options on single stocks, because, you know, I'm not going to get into indices here. Call options on single stocks are normally, especially on the meme stocks, sold by what are called market makers, which are these usually institutional players who their motive is to provide liquidity to the options market. And what they do is they don't want risk. Ideally, a market maker will only make money because they sell to you at the ask and they buy from you at the bid. And they're happy to do this because they're making effectively free money if there's no risk, because they can go around and just whatever that difference is times as many contracts as they, you know, process, that's their profit. But because options have a nonlinear payout, when a market maker, you know, or honestly anybody writes this option contract and sells it to somebody else, they ideally want to hedge it. And when you hedge an option, there's really only one good way, especially on these single stock meme stocks, and that's you buy and sell the underlying shares. And the reason for this is this concept called delta, which I talk about a lot, you know, on Twitter, you know, and it's related to gamma, which is the gamma and gamma squeeze. Effectively, delta is the hedge ratio. So if an option contract is one delta, what that means is it effectively has the payout or the exposure to the market of one share. An option contract can be up to 100 delta, and it increases asymptotically until it hits basically in the money or when it passes the strike price.
Another way also to think about it is that the delta of an option is the probability of that option being in or out of the money at the expiration date.
Exactly. There's a lot of different ways to, you know, understand delta. You know, that's one rough approximation. There's also that this is how much the option price should move based on a dollar change in the underlying. But, you know, for the story, the more interesting one is this is how much exposure the other side has or needs to hedge out to basically write your option without blowing themselves up.
The higher the delta, the more they need to hedge.
Exactly. And what's interesting about delta is it doesn't move like a straight line. It has, you know, this, like I said, convexity. So as the option gets closer to in the money, it starts accruing not only, you know, more exposure to the underlying in terms of value, but the delta actually goes up. And the reason for this is the derivative of delta, which is the exposure of delta to changes in price, is gamma. And that's where the gamma and gamma squeeze comes from.
Right, which is, and it's super important because it, you know, a lot of these folks on Reddit were speculating with short-term call options where the, you know, the closer you get to expiration as well as the closer you get to the price. But in this case, I think the theta component was a big part of the driver. So explain the relationship between gamma and delta for people. And we're going to try to do our best here, but it's kind of difficult. And I'm no expert on options and derivatives, but I want to try and do our best here because I think a lot of people struggle with this.
Definitely. So, I mean, gamma is basically the little sister of delta. So gamma is what makes options fun for most people because you, let's say, buy a very out of money option. So let's say a lot of people in the day trading community call them lottos. A lot of people do it for earnings or these binary events where you either lose all your money or, you know, make a lot of money. And the reason for this is that, you know, if the, let's say the stock price spikes up a lot, then gamma starts, you know, increasing the delta rapidly. So you could start buying a one delta option, which maybe is like 10 cents or $10 because it's times 100. And because, you know, you guess the direction right, guess the magnitude right of the move, it becomes in the money. And you've, instead of, let's say, this could happen for like a 7% move in the underlying, instead of just making 7%, let's say, buying the stock, you've now made 20 times what you put in or 50 times what you put in. So it really appeals to people with like not a lot of capital who have a lot of tolerance for risk, because when you go long an option, when you buy it from somebody else, the amount you can lose is capped. You pay them what's called the premium, which is this amount of money is the most that I'm at risk for, but I could also make a lot more money. And at the same side, the person who sells it, they collect that money, and ideally your option goes to zero and they just made money. But sometimes, you know, especially if they don't hedge, they're on the hook for an infinite amount of money. And, you know, that's what makes it more interesting, because options have what's called implied leverage. So because of this delta and this hedging ratio, they effectively represent this contract to continuously, you know, hedge this position of underlying shares. And when an option gets really in the money, so let's say the strike is 60 and now GameStop is 400, then your option contract effectively has the same rough valuation as controlling 100 shares of GameStop. Mm-hmm. And that's basically due to gamma, because you started with a one delta position. As it went up in value, the delta starts increasing. So now it's a five delta position. As it increases more, it's now a 20 delta position. And then eventually, you know, if you got really lucky, it's 100 delta.
Right. if the option goes in the money. So what role did options buying by retail investors and positioning and the use of leverage, both explicit and implicit, play in the events of the last few weeks? And how does this factor into the retail broker Robinhood's decision to suspend trading in certain story stocks, including GME?
So I'll get into that part about Robinhood last, but effectively what happened, or at least my take on it, and I think this is pretty much widely accepted at this point, is this was now two Fridays ago. GME was pretty stable that week. It had actually, opened up on the prior Monday, like 50%, which was pretty substantial. But after that, it kind of just stayed stagnant for a couple of days. And this was actually when Citroen, published their hit report and Wall Street Bets went to war with them. But what effectively happened was when Citroen published their report, what's called an unusual option sweep, which was actually, I detected it through Unusual Whales, which is one of these services. He's also a friend of mine, so love the guy. He detected, I believe, through his, sweeper that looks at these option flows, about $1 million worth of puts opened on GME when Citroen published their report. And this is a public feed. So not only he detected it, but this is all public OPRA data. So everybody who could see sweeps saw that $1 million worth of puts hit GME, which was a very bearish bet meant to tank the stock. And then Citroen's report came out like minutes later. And what happened was, that week it was basically a full-on war between Wall Street Bets and Citroen. People were buying shares, probably buying calls. It wasn't doing much to move the stock because, I'll talk about this more later, retail doesn't have as much of an effect on this as they probably thought they did. But what's more interesting on Friday is a lot of these put options, when you buy an option, it's effectively as a promise of a possibility. So if you buy a put, let's say at 30 and GameStop at 40, over time, the opportunity of GameStop to move to $30 diminishes because you have less time remaining on your contract. So the value of the contract...
Yeah, the delta declines.
So it's actually, not only does the delta decline, which is this concept of delta decay or charm, which is a second derivative, but the price of the option contract itself also declines. And, the delta decline is related to theta, which is the price of the option diminishing. But what's interesting in the Friday case, the initial Friday where GME exploded, was that a lot of these options had what's called 0 days expiration. So 0 days are, there's a lot of choice words I think they use to describe them online, but they're basically lottery tickets. Effectively, you either go home rich or you go home broke. There's really no in between because on the 0th day of the contract, there's so little value remaining. And as you tick closer to the market closing, the value exponentially decreases. So by midday,
so was people's ability to buy, or the fact that they were buying 0 day to expiration options, how important was that in the strategy of the subreddit to drive the price up? Because they could effectively drive it up in a day and they could buy these options super cheap and exercise them in the money because they managed to get the stock price up so quickly. Is that like a huge part of how this worked?
I mean, it is most likely what happened on Friday. This was, I think, the 15th of January. I don't think it was cooperative. I think it was just people took advantage because what was happening was these put options were bought on GME and they were expiring or losing delta, which meant that the people who wrote the contracts could then, go back and buy GME stock, which was pushing the price back up. And people, speculators, not only, on Wall Street Bets, but everywhere, saw GME going up and, took this bet that it would continue to go up parabolically because that's what it had been doing previously. So they bought these cheap 0 days, which had certain delta, but when you buy them together, what happens is that the market makers who wrote you the contracts need to keep buying shares. Mm-hmm. And when you keep buying shares, it keeps pushing up the price, which keeps pushing up the value of other people's contracts, which keeps pushing up the price more, which keeps basically encouraging more people to start buying in because they're seeing the stock go parabolic. And they're saying, I want to, you know, make some money today. So you get this kind of virtuous cycle where, you know, there was some small initial movement, mostly, you know, driven likely by, you know, normal speculation, buying pressure, some shorts closing out, put hedges being unwound. And then you get this parabolic cycle that people started buying in, which caused the price to go up, which caused more buying in, which caused the price to go up more. Mm-hmm. And one of the telltale signs here of the gamma squeeze was that GME's price on that day settled around the highest strike price available on GameStop, which was $60. So what happens when an option goes in the money is that it doesn't really have much gamma anymore. Once it hits 100 delta, there really isn't much it can do to change the price because you're already controlling the maximum amount of shares it could have. So mm-hmm. when that happens, you get this, you know, concept of the people that own, you know, these option contracts or wrote them for you, the market makers, they're what's called, you know, short delta. So they actually, you know, in the state of short delta, they start selling, or sorry, short gamma, they start selling these shares. And when they start selling the shares, the price goes down. But then people are still buying in because they're like, okay, it might go back up. And eventually you get this equilibrium where it started to settle around the gamma, you know, point of no return, which for that date was $60.
Okay, so I want to make sure we get to the narrative component of this story. So maybe it would be best to just ask you directly, what do you think the big picture story here is that a lot of people are missing?
I mean, I think there's a couple of things people are really missing, and this is what I see most on the news. You know, one, this idea of retail mania. Like, yeah, it is, of course, a retail bubble. No question about that. You can see that just based on the growth of Wall Street Bets as a subreddit. But, you know, we have pretty strong evidence. I talked to a lot of people on financial Twitter that most of this movement is not driven by retail. The initial movement was, you know, there are a lot of firms out there, a lot of high, you know, frequency firms in particular that have algorithms that are designed, you know, to scout for momentum stocks and basically ride these trends. And when you get this frenzy, a lot of the heavy movement is done by these firms, which zoom in and out of positions and, you know, bid up the price, you know, to this extraordinary amount. So I think a lot of, especially the movement this past week, was mostly driven by, you know, these algorithms by these large institutions rather than, you know, this narrative that, oh, this is just a war between, you know, the good retail and evil hedge funds. It's like, no, there are hedge funds on both sides playing you guys both for fools.
So the subreddit was kind of like the igniter.
It lit
the fuse, but it was all the opportunistic money flooding in that really provided the gasoline for the punch.
Exactly. I mean, no question it would have gone up, you know, to some degree just by retail alone. But, you know, we've found evidence that retail is maybe like 20% of the driver here. You know, there is a short squeeze component, as, you know, I talked about briefly before. I do not believe it was the initial, you know, driver of momentum. But of course, as the stock went up in value astronomically, shorts do get blown out. You know, that's not something that anybody questions. But,
yeah,
you know, we're seeing now that the short interest is probably closer to like 40 to 50%. So, you know, most of those shorts kind of learned their lesson.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also this weird, now let's just kind of, let's just free flow now, and it'll give us a chance to really get into the most fun stuff here, which is the narrative component. One of the competing narratives, as I said, there's a kind of narrative war going on, and a lot of people are pumping their own narratives, pumping their own interests, whatever it happens to be. And one of those narratives is that there are evil short sellers out there, and that what this really was partly, not only was this sticking it to the man, so to speak, but the man was partly people that were short mm-hmm. GameStop, and by extension, short in general, that if you're short companies, you're short innovation, you're short entrepreneurialism, et cetera, et cetera. I think, you know, there's something else too, and now I'm just I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. I'm curious what you think about it. I noticed when this story started to really pick up traction that certain, you know, how would you call them, cultish, popular, pop cult billionaires went on CNBC and basically led what sounded like, were trying to lead what sounded like a populist revolt. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, when someone like Chamath went on CNBC, to me, it sounded a lot like Donald Trump. It sounded a lot like Donald Trump during the Republican primary. And the sort of Stephen Cohens and Ken Griffins of this world were kind of like the Jeb Bushes, right? Like mm-hmm. the establishment. And it's interesting to me because it seems like there's a lot of bleed from what's happening inside in American politics to what's going on in financial markets. I wonder if you've picked up on that at all.
I did, actually. I've talked about a lot with myself about memetics, and it's really, I mean, at least my view is it's the same source. You know, when you have this market, which, and we'll talk about this more later, is so driven by the narrative and so driven by, you know, the idea of a meme and not the internet meme, but literally the Richard Dawkins level, you know, understanding of a meme, then it makes perfect sense because, you know, these billionaires, you know, Chamath and Elon are attached to these storybook stocks. You know, Chamath has his SPACs, Elon has Tesla, and I talk a lot about Tesla in the sense of the God meme. I don't want to, of course, mix any enemies here. You know, I do think that, you know, they both inserted themselves in this narrative as, you know, this way to propagate their own.
Yeah, it was very opportunistic. Meme. Very opportunistic.
Exactly. It was done in a very calculated way. Do I agree with what they did? Absolutely not. You know, I think we're seeing today the ramifications that when, you know, these billionaires who they may have invested some in GameStop, you know, at this level, you know, it's literally what people would call a YOLO for them. You know, they don't care if they lose money. It looks, you know, good. Their stock price will pump just because people, you know, have this salience recognition of them. But real people follow them, you know, and that's the danger here. Like there should have been warning klaxons for people that they should have a social responsibility here to warn people, this is a bubble. This will not end well. You know, this will end well for a few people and a lot less well for a lot of people. And, you know, I think it's a problem. You know, a lot of people try to score these easy points, you know, with these stories, and it's very feels good and it makes them seem like, oh, we're not the bad billionaires. The other people are the bad billionaires.
Exactly. Donald Trump. Trump, when Chamath was on with Scott Wapner, Scott looked bewildered. And I feel like that's partly because there's been this kind of revolt that these guys are trying to lead. And again, in a very, very populist way. You see it also with Davy Day Trader. That's another phenomenon. I mean, he was brilliant in really taking advantage of the crowd and leading people over the summer with that whole kind of stonks investing thing. What do you think this says, like, about where we are today and the way in which people are investing? Like, I've talked about it as a kind of a rise of what I call market nihilism, you know? Is there an embrace among millennials that you're seeing in some of these online forums, an embrace of the idea that value is totally dead, nothing matters, Jay Powell has the money printer go burr, and the only thing that matters is basically the pump?
I mean, of course, yeah. I mean, in general, I would argue all three of these people, so like you said, Davy Day Trader, you know, Chamath, Elon, they have a vested interest in keeping up current with the media and being salient in people's minds, because those people, you know, mostly subconsciously, when they look for stocks, will keep their stocks in mind. You know, I'm not saying that's their only motivation here. I don't even know if that's their, you know, conscious motivation here. But in general, we're seeing over the past year that the most salient stocks win. It doesn't matter what their PD is. It doesn't matter what their cash flows is. A lot of the initial value investors in GameStop were like, oh, but they have $750 million in free cash. Like, no, dude, nobody cares about that. Literally nobody.
Yeah, isn't that, it's wild.
$400 a share is buying GameStop because their cash flow is $750.
Yeah, because and if you say that, they're going to call you a boomer.
I mean, basically, I mean.
Which is a fascinating sort of put down, because you don't have to actually be a baby boomer to be called a boomer. As I understand it, a boomer is basically someone who doesn't get it. who's basically living in the old paradigm, but there's a new paradigm and there are new rules. And narratives really do drive that. And I mean, I've seen that time and time again, not just in some of these story stocks like Tesla, or most recently with GameStop, or with Hertz, just the temporary kind of pump that it had, even though it was in bankruptcy, which is wild, but in crypto assets and cryptocurrencies as well. So you mentioned salience. You have this really interesting model that you use to analyze story stocks and these types of companies. One aspect that's relevant is salience, which is kind of like the memorability of something. You have something else you call catalyst, which you'll have to explain to me, and also humor. How does your framework work for evaluating stocks that you think are poised to benefit from this kind of like narrative flow?
Effectively, it's really, you need to have this pulse on the trend. I mean, I'm looking at ways to quantitatively model it. It's, as I mentioned in my post, it's very difficult because a lot of these patterns that humans get intuitively, good luck writing an algorithm to, you know, actually model it. I think a lot of quant firms have been stuck for years trying to figure out good ways to do semantic modeling. But effectively, you know, this actually came to me a lot in the last couple of days with the idea of a silver squeeze. You know, when you look at GameStop or when you look at Tesla, they have a lot of, you know, resemblance in my post I mentioned to the monomyth, you know, this hero's journey of Joseph Campbell, where you start with this protagonist who, you know, Tesla, for instance, we could say is Elon. You know, he went through trials and tribulations. You know, they almost went bankrupt earlier, late 2019, I believe, with Model 3. You know, they came out victorious against these short sellers. You know, short sellers are often cast as the villains in these storybook stocks because even though they're on the side of common sense, you know, nobody, I mean, I'll get a lot of flack for this, but nobody could value Tesla properly by any known valuation metric.
Yeah.
And, you know, you really need this idea of the story, this narrative that has this attachment to a basal human emotion, as I talk about, which in Tesla case, you know, this idea of futurism or a better future. You know, Elon and Tesla have heavily benefited from Elon's continual mad scientist-y plans to get humans on Mars, you know, build these tunnels that connect between cities. None of these
upload
really
your brain
have
to the cloud.
Exactly. And time will tell if he does any of this. You know, of course, SpaceX, you know, is a real company doing real things. But a lot of what drove Tesla's stock, I'd argue, was this idea that I am not only banking on the chance to make money through this, but I am committing the moral action to enhance humanity's future. That's why Tesla has so many rabid fans. You know, it isn't because they're analyzing, you know, cash flows or, you know, trying to come up with logical models to value it. It's like, no, this has an emotional attachment for people. And you saw a lot of the same thing with GameStop.
But how do you measure that? Because, like, you call Tesla a god meme in your writing. It's because of just how powerful it is. And you use this metaphor, you stretch it to describe also a blast radius, that you can see that in cases like the success of Cathie Wood's ARK Invest and some of these other knockoff EV companies, which is really fascinating. I mean, it makes sense intuitively, but how do you measure it? How do you quantify this?
I think that's a trillion-dollar question, right? You know, it's very easy as a human to say, you know, when you see it. I mean, like I said, or like you said, it makes sense intuitively. You know, this model of a semantic network where stocks that, you know, have this strong or even weaker associations with the Tesla narrative are benefiting when Tesla does. And I mean, we saw last week Tesla, you know, not only missed earnings, but more importantly, was dethroned for some time by GameStop. And stuff in the Tesla bubble, like ARK Invest, like, you know, Eichlin, like EV companies in general, you know, battery companies, they all went down because all these cash flows were moving from Tesla to the next god meme, as I call it. So how does one quantify
Dogecoin.
It? Dogecoin. You know, Dogecoin. How does one quantify it is a great question. I mean, I am personally going to look into various strategies. I think the most obvious approach is that, you know, when one of these god memes appears, whether on Wall Street Bets or on Twitter or whatever, you can look at how it impacts other stocks in its radius. you know, it follows a pretty well-established pattern, which I talk about in my blog post, that it could not only vary in proportion. So let's say, you know, the God meme is silver. In silver's case, you know, we would expect that fairly instantly the miners would go up. And they did. Let's take it a step further. We would see that other precious metals should start rallying too. And we saw that. We saw gold, we saw platinum. Now let's take it a step further. Let's say there's more money still inflowing. Where would it go? Okay, other metals. So you saw yesterday, for instance, American Steel rallied for no reason.
You would need a lot of data across a lot of different asset classes and over a wide time period to be able to determine if this is actually a persistent phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at more from that. Instead of trying to semantically model it, you can look for these correlations that appear in the market data itself. So instead of trying to, you know, piece together, let's say, you know, SEC filings and Wall Street Bets lingo, you can look at it from the perspective of how do these stocks move together and are they linked? You can see this through pretty much basic signals analysis. These correlations do break down over time, of course, you know, and I think one of the major things to look for if you do try to monetize a strategy on this is really understanding, are these correlations spurious? So you do want some method of, once you identify these baskets, you want to identify, you know, the centroid or the God meme here. You want to identify, is this a real semantic relationship? Because, for instance, if you just look at one day, you might think that Tesla and private prisons are directly correlated, you know, rather anti-correlated. And they are through a semantic association here, which is, you know, the blue wave, you know, this idea of a democratic, you know, narrative to the market. But, you know, they may not be in a couple of months. And, you know, there is a lot of data filtering. I do intend to work on this more once my primary model is in a good place, which is the NOPE, you know, but it is a good way to analyze these stocks, whether you're an institutional investor or an individual investor, because a great example with GameStop was, you know, when I saw this new God meme occurring, we had this idea of a blast radius. So a ton of money was pouring into GameStop. Where does it go when GameStop gets too rich for people's blood? It goes to first other shorted stocks, which, you know, my model I call the L1 or level one. It then goes to, let's say, the other distressed retailers, which are the L2. It goes to products that GameStop may carry. It goes to other companies that are related to the central characters of the narrative. And a great example I actually posted on Twitter during the GameStop story was this company, Designer Brands. And it was similar to GameStop in a lot of ways. It's not heavily shorted, but it's, you know, a distressed retailer that the stock price was very much dampened still from pre-COVID. But what was more important about it was its affiliation with Michael Burry, who was the central character in the GameStop story. And based on this association, I said, okay, Michael Burry must have made a shit ton off GameStop. Other people will now look at his 13F, which, you know, for Cyan Acid Madman, they will look for it to find other stocks which will replicate the GameStop story. Which stocks here could replicate the next GameStop? And from that, and, you know, doing a bunch of digging, I pulled out Designer Brands.
So a couple questions. One, is this a thing where you're obviously looking to consciously predict where people are going to go in the event that the opportunity in a particular stock has been depleted, at least temporarily, and they want to find a similar opportunity in a different stock? Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay, so you're doing that consciously. The question is, are the people whose actions you're attempting to predict, is your assumption, your working assumption, that the vast majority of those people are subconsciously moving from one stock to another? Or is there a conscious herding, conscious behavior that is developed within the sort of the online internet culture community in finance and stocks where they actually are doing the same thing that you're doing?
It's honestly impossible to tell. I mean, I would argue it probably doesn't matter too much if it is conscious or subconscious for other people. Pretty, you know, common example.
So this is like massive momentum play.
It is. I mean, in a common example, and this is not even a, you know, new concept. It's really, it originates with John Maynard Keynes, you know, one of the fathers of modern economics. Keynesian beauty contests.
Mm-hmm.
How are stocks valued? Do we value them based on what we think they're worth? And the answer is usually no. We actually value it according to what we think other people think they're worth. And
right.
What's more interesting about that is you can take it a step further. And you would say that a rational actor in the system would act the same way as you. So everybody who is buying a stock or selling a stock is trying to predict what other people are thinking.
Right. So here's a question for you. No, completely. And you talk about reflexivity in your work. I mean, it's something that I've talked about on this program before. But reflexivity depends on the existence of a fundamental sort of empirically discernible reality, which ultimately works as an anchoring mechanism for expectations. I feel like what we're describing here is the reflexive loop, the momentum, mm-hmm. right? I guess, I don't know, I'm trying to discern basically, because a lot of people, when I go on different internet forums or when I get invited to some like Discord channel or I'm on a Telegram channel or someone's DMing me and telling me, hey, you know, like everyone's talking about Chainlink right now. It's like all over like Reddit, like it's going to pump. I'm just like, is this the new kind of, because there's this perception of many in crypto in particular, because of the nature of the assets, the fact that they're financial, that, you know, adoption or pumping something is the same thing as it having value. You know, there's like this conflation between underlying value and hype. And I wonder, I guess, do you see what I'm saying? Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what I talk about a lot with this idea of the narrative loop. It's really that there's a catalyst. You know, I don't say catalyst because it's often not even real or necessarily based on reality. It's really based on this understanding that people think that, you know, when you see these meme bubbles, and a great example actually of this is like Workhorse Motors early in the summer or Nikola, there's always something in the future that people can believe will provide value for what they're doing. Nobody likes to admit to themselves that this is a pure mania play, and you saw that heavily with GameStop. I mean, that was the whole adoption of the short squeeze narrative plus the value angle. It was, you know, if someone put a gun to my head and was like, why GameStop? Why now? It would be that, basically. You know, it was spurred by Ryan Cohen, you know, joining the board, catalyst number one. It was spurred by the holiday season and this belief that, you know, consoles would somehow save the ailing retailer, catalyst two. But, you know, the overarching fundamental belief was that, okay, there is this event in the near future that I could make a lot of money off of. Ergo, I can justify to myself these inflated prices. And you saw this with Workhorse with the UPS contract. You saw this with Nikola when, you know, they got this GM contract that never happened. It's this idea that, you know, there is some kernel of truth here, which people latch onto. It doesn't need to be an actual truth. It could be completely false, you know. And with that, people will justify this reflexive loop to themselves.
Yeah, it's super interesting. I strongly recommend for listeners to check out your work. What's the URL of your blog, Lily?
Nope. nope-its-lily.medium.com.
Yeah, I have a lot of stuff from, I mean, I pulled a lot of quotes from all your different posts that were relevant to this story. There are actually five, but you've written a lot of other stuff as well. And I put a lot of that stuff in the rundown. I also have a lot of images from your post and a lot of really, really funny, interesting memes from the internet related to this story. What interests me in this is because I do feel like there is this weird hyper-reality that we're living in right now. And also, again, I mentioned it earlier, this nihilistic component. And I feel like, you know, people going and buying Dogecoin is a perfect example of that. It's an absolutely worthless thing that was created as a joke. But everyone's not just doing it, they're embracing it. It's a really weird thing. And a lot of people on the internet and social media have been trying to suggest that it's a wonderful thing, that, you know, all values are arbitrary. And so it doesn't really matter what you buy. Again, but that shows a fundamental, I think, lack of understanding about what the role of financial markets, like why are financial markets are there? They're not there for us to gamble. I know that a lot of people gamble in financial markets, but that's not why we have wheat futures. You know, you can speculate in wheat futures all you want, but they actually play a really important role in the underlying economy and helping to act as a signal for supply and demand of a really important food staple. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately this derives from the fact that we've made money free and that people have lost faith in the institution of money as well. And they just basically see stocks as all stonks and just it's all about the pump. So anyway, Lily, I really appreciate you coming on. For everyone listening, in place of the overtime, I'm recording a segment with Ash Bennington, senior editor and crypto editor at Real Vision Next, who also incidentally had Lily on Real Vision's Daily Briefing, and who also hosts his own podcast. That's going to be available on the Overtime feed in time for this episode's publication. So if you aren't a subscriber yet to our premium content or have access to our private RSS feed, that's not a problem. You can just scroll down to the bottom of the summary page to this episode and click on the link that says patreon.com/hiddenforces. There's also a link to our website at hiddenforces.io where you can explore our content library and sign up to the podcast mailing list. Lily, I want to give you the last word here. Do you have any closing remarks you want to make or anything you want to add?
Definitely. I mean, I guess the last remark on what you just said is, you know, I completely agree. There is an awesome post written by my friend Andrew on this, you know, as a follow-up to my series on trading salience about hyper-reality and this idea of stocks. I think a lot of it does relate to this idea of economic anxiety, you know, especially among my generation. A lot of people, when pressed to the wall of why they do this, you know, everybody understands it's a bad idea. You know, nobody sensibly thinks GME is worth $468 a share. Nobody is gambling in the markets because, you know, they're completely unaware of what's going to happen or what the risks are. It's really, they believe that this is their only chance to, you know, economic salvation.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people do this, and I've seen multiple stories because I've run a Discord on this and, you know, talk to traders a lot. A lot of people are in the markets for very dangerous reasons. And I do intend to write more posts on how speculation by itself is, you know, as I call it, fucking up the marketplace. Mm-hmm. But I do just want to, you know, leave your listeners with this, that, you know, this is a cultural concern. You know, we've created a system where a lot of people, you know, feel pretty much consigned to a social caste, and they're seeing this as their grand opportunity to get out. And, you know, if you look at it through that lens, it's completely natural what's happening, I would argue.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally agree with you. So Lily, thanks again for coming on the program. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you for having me.
Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page at patreon.com/hiddenforces. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nikolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.